Hello, this is Jane Cowell.
Jane Cowell, one of America's best-loved actresses, with a program about everyday happenings, a little about everything, some things closest to our minds, and perhaps some things farthest from our minds. Now, Jane Cowell.
Well, listeners, he's here in the studio, Frederick March, and I don't blame the women of this country much for their devotion. In a few minutes, you'll hear from him, but now for a few items I must take up.
Jane.
Yes, Ken?
Do you know what I think? I think you ought to have a rumor department
here.
You know, so often people are bewildered by the news. There's such a lot of conflicting reports flying around. Take, for instance...
Oh, Ken, don't tell me you're one of those characters who believes every whisper that runs through the grapevine.
Oh, of course not, Jane. I'm not that dumb, but it might be an idea to take one rumor every day and sort of push it around a little.
Well, I'm no expert,
No, but you think pretty straight for a woman.
Well, thank you.
I'm not kidding, Jane. You know, I hear so much, I don't know what to believe. I'd like to know if you think there is any truth in the whispering campaign that peace terms have already been settled with the Germans, and that we could announce VE Day if we wanted to.
It may quite well be true, Ken.
Well, if so, why should General Eisenhower hold up the news? Sounds pretty arbitrary to me.
Well, just stop and think for a moment. If the surrender has been completed, mind you, I say if, it still would take time to get the armies organized to stop the war, just as we had to organize to fight it. Suppose we announce it before all the firing ceases. Well, think how a lot of parents would feel if their boys were killed after the official surrender. A bullet doesn't know anything about dates, you know. As a matter of fact, 10 men were killed in Italy after the Germans surrendered to General Alexander.
You don't tell me. That's bad.
Yes, and obviously General Eisenhower wants to avoid happenings like this.
Of course. It seems reasonable.
And don't forget, the Allies must be in a position to throw combined forces against the Japanese. Though I'm not in the confidence of the authorities, it would seem sensible to me to quietly move some of our troops and materiel to the east before we announce the finish of the European war. Every day saved is a day nearer peace.
Well, say, I'm glad I brought this up.
You're welcome, and a little thing I can do for you like that.
All right, I'll come back for more.
Today we come to the last program in our series of The Birth of a Play. Since Monday, we've been tracing the building of a Broadway hit, A Bell for Adorno. We began with the authors, then we talked to the producer. On Wednesday, we heard from the designer and the stage manager, and yesterday from the press agent and the critic. We've covered the writing, the business end, the advertising, and backstage. But until this moment, we've not said very much about the chief element in the playing of any theatrical production, the actors. Most of you have read A Bell for Adorno, and I'm sure it follows that most of you have had an idea of your own about what Major Joffolo should look like, how big he is, how he walks, or even how he talks. Filling out your picture of the Major, making him real and alive, was the job that fell to the star of A Bell for Adorno, who's grinning at me now across this microphone, Frederick March. Freddy, you must be everybody's idea of Major Joffolo.
Well, I know, Jane, the Major's a pretty definite sort of person, you know. Visualizing him wasn't too difficult. Developing him was.
Well, that's always the worst of it. Mm. Read a play or a book and you can see the character you want to play as clear as your own image in the mirror. And then start to turn that image into gestures and inflections. Well, that's what makes acting a fine art, Freddie.
Yeah, and when you're in love with the character.
Well, then it's fun.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever done a play that you didn't fall in love with, Jane?
A few, a very few.
Mm-hmm.
But I've been lucky. Most of my good parts have been in plays that I really liked. And if they weren't at the start, they were by the time we brought them into New York.
And that's the chief excitement in preparing a play, don't you think? I mean, haven't you found it so in your experience?
Yes, yes, I have. Now, don't think I'm not onto the trick you're playing, Mr. March. Who's interviewing whom on this program anyway?
All right, you win. Where do we begin?
In the usual place. Mm. When did you first read the script?
Well, as a matter of fact, it was sometime after I'd told Leland Haywood, the producer, I'd do the part.
Oh, then he talked to you about it before the play was written?
That's right.
Yes.
Yeah, we were at a dinner party at a friend's house, and after dinner, Leland took me aside and said, Freddie, I just bought a book. I'm going to have a play made from it. It's called A Bell for Adorno. I said to him, let's sit down, Bob, and talk this over.
Was it settled just like that at one sitting?
Pretty much so. Mm-hmm. Of course, I told him he was cockeyed. You know, nobody buys the dramatic rights after the movie rights have been sold, and you can't make any money that way, as you know. But he wanted to do it, and so he did.
Tell me, were there many changes after you saw the first draft of the script?
Yes, there were quite a few. For example, that first draft had 157 pages in it.
Oh, well, then you must have cut, almost 40 pages, I'd say.
I'd say just about that. I still marvel at how much there is left.
So do I. It's a grand job all around. By the way, Freddie, I like the way you handled the Bronx dialect. Or perhaps lilt would be a better word.
It's funny you mention that. The first stage director we talked to about directing it, he should be nameless, he wouldn't undertake the play on account of what he called language difficulties. I mean, he wanted to know how we could give the impression that Joplo was talking Italian to the natives and pure Bronx to the GIs. And he said it was impossible. But when Hank Potter took over, although he didn't agree with this completely, he did say, this will break your heart, Freddie, but no Italian stuff.
And so, no Italian stuff.
Exactly. We were sort of stumped for a while. And Paul said, play it straight.
Without any accent?
Yeah. Mm. So I kind of wondered what this Middle Western speech, or whatever it is I have normally, would sound like from a man who was a truck driver, a cabbie, and whatnot, in the Bronx. I mean, it just didn't seem right to me. So finally I said, look, you don't want to lose the Bronx completely, so let me go overboard with it first, and then we'll taper it down later.
Was it very hard to work out?
No, not very. I mean, it was just the difference in saying, you know, when we walk into the huge room and look around in our entrance, say, look at that floor, marble. Maybe we should have brought our roller skates. Or saying, look at that floor, marble. Should have brought our roller skates.
Just that difference. Mm. Sounds like the difference between Frederick March and Major Joplo.
The payoff came at the run-through we did for Mrs. Osborne and Mrs. Potter. I mean, we'd sort of kept the wives away until then. So when we were through, Mrs. Osborne said to Paul, you know, that accent of Freddie's, Paul, it was just enough. And Paul said, what accent? He'd been hearing it so much he didn't notice anymore. But compared to the real Joplo, the real Major, golly.
The real Major?
Yeah, I mean the one that John Hersey, the author of the book, lived with over there. He came home on leave recently. His name is Toscani, Lieutenant Colonel Frank Toscani. And he said to me about his experience with Hersey, excuse me, he said, imagine, Freddie, the guy lives with me 5 days and nights, and I didn't even know he was interviewing me. A Bronx accent. Well, Frank was the most Bronx guy I ever met in my life.
So the answer to even a successful dialect is care and more care.
I guess so, Jane. Mm.
The size of the cast, Freddie, is amazing. You ought to win a prize for all the type somebody found for it.
And Leland and Hank Potter consulted together about the casting for weeks. In fact, we all sat up there in Leland's office discussing actors day after day for hours. You take the sergeant, Sergeant Boris. We talked about a lot of men in Hollywood. Well, I don't know, those boys don't particularly want to leave all that money out there for a gamble on Broadway.
No.
And somebody said Everett Sloan for the sergeant. And I said, get him and get him quick. Give him a run-of-the-play contract.
Mm. And Margot, that girl gives a beautiful performance.
Beautiful,
Tina.
Beautiful indeed. And Bruce McFarlane. Mm. And I think we're extremely fortunate with the whole cast.
Yes, you are, Freddie. You know, all through this week, I've noticed something about the story of Abel Ferrandano that I like very much. And I think it's one reason for the play's success.
What's that?
Well, Elizabeth Montgomery told me how the scenery was planned with everybody in on the conferences.
Mm-hmm.
Paul Osborne and John Hersey gave the same impression. And everybody, including yourself, uses the pronoun we.
You mean it was a collective enterprise?
Yes, exactly. Everyone gave his or her best. It was a group project, almost, and the give and take is wonderful.
Why are you surprised at that, Jane?
Well, it doesn't often happen in the theater.
Mm.
And it's not only refreshing to hear about it, but it makes me more sure than ever that we're heading for a lot of good theaters if this trend continues.
I hope so. Well, when you're dealing with a script that has as much to say about democracy as this one has, no one can help practicing it.
Yes,
really,
true enough. And that's quite a definition of democracy the major gives the townspeople. How does it go, Freddie?
Well, you want me to do it?
Yes, I do.
A drop of a hat. Why, he says to them something like, one of the main things about a democracy is that the men of the government are no longer the masters of the people. They are the servants of the people. They're elected by the people, paid by the people with their taxes. Therefore, you are now the servants of the people of Adana. I, too, am their servant. When I go to buy bread, I shall take my place at the end of the line and wait my turn. Well, if I find any of you not acting in this way, I shall remove you from office. Just remember, you are now the servants, not the rulers of the people of Adano. And watch. You may find that this thing will make you happier than you've ever been in your life.
Oh, thank you, Freddy. It's good to hear the simple essence of our way of living stated so plainly.
Well, when you believe what you're saying, Jane, it's that much easier to speak plainly, don't you think?
Yes, yes, I do. I'd like a lot of people to hear that speech to the GIs in the second act.
You want me to do it?
Yes, please.
No urging at all, Miss Carmen. Why, he has the three lined up there, the three GIs, and he just says, look, if we're ever going to get anywhere on this thing, it's going to take every man we got trying to figure the right thing to do. We got a tough job ahead of us. But we can lick it because in our army, we got damn near every race in Europe. No other country in the world, there's so many men who speak the language of the countries we've got to invade. Whose parents have come from there, and that's our chance. Because until there's something stable in Europe, our armies will have to stay here. And it won't be any plans put down on paper that's going to guarantee whether we can lick this job. It's only our men can guarantee it. Only you and me, and then the rest of us here. And just as good as we can make things over here, that's just how good they'll be at home. What you guys do today may have a lot to do with what your kids and their kids will be doing for years to come. For God's sake, let's grab this chance to bring a little sense and decency and hope into the world again. It all depends just how good we can be.
Thank you, Freddy. I'm extremely glad you could be here to tie together the whole story of Adano for us. And good luck to you and a long life to the play.
Thank you, Jane.
This completes the story of The Birth of a Play. You've all heard a little now of what goes into the making of a hit, in this case, The Bell for Adano. It seems to me that this was one project in the theater that deserved its success because success was earned by all the hard work and devotion that went into the production. Good theater demands that of the people who love it sincerely.
You have been listening to Jane Cowell with her special guest, Frederick March, star of the Broadway hit A Bell for Adano, on this final program in the series on The Birth of a Play. This quarter hour is reserved for you and Jane Cowell.
On Monday, I shall have a few personal items just for you, and here with me will be a war correspondent with news of your sons on the battlefield, Gordon Walker of the Christian Science Monitor. Until Monday, then, this is Jane Cowell.
Jane Cowell comes to you from our mutual studios in New York. Miss Cowell is heard over most of these stations Monday through Friday at 2:15 Eastern Wartime. This is the Mutual Broadcasting System.